passengers. But don't ever tell me to be proud of my father.
All right, said Kolya, holding up his hands. All right, I'm sorry. I didn't mean it like that. I just meant we're not strangers anymore.
I feel like an idiot, said Sonya. Forgive me, Lev, I haven't heard of your father. He was a poet?
A great one, said Kolya.
Fair to middling, he always said. He told me for his generation there was Mayakovsky and everyone else, and he was right there in the center section with everyone else.
No, no, don't listen to him. He was a fine writer. Truly, Lev, I'm not saying this to be kind. An old poet, once famous, seen at a cafe. Wonderful poem.
That was the poem in all the anthologies, at least all the anthologies printed before 1937. I had read it dozens of times since they took my father, but it had been years since I heard another voice speak the title.
And he was...
Here Sonya made a motion with her chin, an over-there motion. It could mean anything. Sent to Siberia, shot in the back of the head, silenced on orders of the Central Committee. The specifics were never known.
He was removed? She was asking.
And I nodded. I have that poem memorized, said Kolya, but he did me a favor and didn't recite it. The apartment door opened and Timofey, one of the surgeons I'd met the previous night, walked over to warm his hands by the stove. When he noticed Darling sitting in her nesting box, he crouched and inspected her, his hands on his knees.
Where did this come from?
Kolya and Lev got him from a boy near the Narva Gate. Timofey stood and grinned at us. He pulled two large onions from the pockets of his overcoat.
Got these at the hospital. Wasn't planning on sharing, but seems to me we've got the possibility of a beautiful soup tonight.
Darling's not for the pot, said Kolya. We need her for the eggs.
The eggs, Timofey looked at us, at Darling, back to us. He seemed to think we were joking.
Everyone's quitting on Darling, Kolya continued. But I think she's got it in her. Do you know anything about chickens? You think she could lay a dozen by Thursday? What the hell are you talking about?
The surgeon seemed more and more irritated. Kolya glared back at him, insulted by the man's tone.
Don't you speak Russian? We're waiting for the eggs.
For a moment, I thought the conversation would turn violent, which would have been a bad thing for the Red Army. We needed our surgeons, and Kolya would have splattered the man with a single punch. But Timofey finally laughed, shaking his head, waiting for us to laugh with him.
Laugh all you want to, I told him. You're not touching the chicken.
It's not a chicken, you idiot. It's a rooster.
Kolya hesitated, not sure if this was a joke the surgeon was playing, or a trick to get us to throw Darling into the soup. I leaned forward in my chair and peered at the bird. I don't know why I thought peering would help. What was I looking for, little balls?
You're saying she won't lay eggs?
Asked Kolya, watching Timofey carefully. The surgeon spoke slowly, as if he were conferring with morons.
It's a he, and the odds aren't good.
Chapter 10. That night the soup tasted like June. Like the dinners we remembered before the siege. An admirer of Sonya's, a pilot in the VVS, had given her an unspoiled potato. Kolya protested that he didn't want to eat the gift of another lover, but his complaints were ignored, as he had hoped, and the darling soup was thick with potato and onion and plenty of salt. Happily for us, the other surgeons were spending the night somewhere else. Sonya traded a wing and a cup of broth to her neighbor for a bottle of drinkable vodka. The Germans lobbed only a few lazy shells at the city, as if to remind us they were still there, but had better things to do on this particular evening. By midnight we were drunk, our bellies full, Kolya and Sonya fucking in the bedroom, while I played speed chess with Timofey by the light of the stove. Halfway through the second game, I moved my knight. Timofey stared at the board, burped, and said,
"Oh, you're good.
You just figured it out? I mated you in 16 moves last game. Thought it was the drink. I'm fucked, aren't I? You're still alive. Won't be long, though." He tipped over his king and burped again, pleased with his burping, pleased there was food in his stomach. Not much point in that. Oh, well, you can't tell a chicken from a rooster, but you know chess. I used to be better. I right-sided his king and played his move for him, trying to see how long I could extend the endgame. You used to be better? When you were an embryo? What are you, 14? 17. Are you shaving yet? Yes. Timofey looked skeptical. I shaved my mustache. It grows slower in the winter. Sonya gasped in the other room and began to laugh, forcing me to picture her, her head tilted back, her throat exposed, her nipples hard on her small breasts. I don't know where they get the energy, said Timofey, lying back on the layered blankets and stretching his arms. Give me chicken soup every night, and I'll never need another woman as long as I live. He closed his eyes, and soon he was asleep, another of the fast sleepers, leaving me alone to listen to the lovers. Kolya woke me before dawn, handing me a cup of tea as he studied the abandoned chessboard. Timofey still slept on his back, his mouth open, his arms stretched above his head, as if he were surrendering to the enemy. Who was playing black? Me. You had him in six? I had him in five, unless he made a mistake, and then I had him in three. Kolya frowned, looked at the pieces until he figured it out. You know how to play. You still want to make that bet? What was it, nude pictures of French girls? He smiled, rubbing the sleep from his eyes. I should just give them to you as a favor, show you where all the parts are. Come on, get your boots on. Where are we going? Nga. Kolya might have been a deserter, but he had enough natural authority in his voice that my boots were half-laced before I thought to question his directive. He had already slipped on his greatcoat and leather gloves. He looped his scarf twice around his neck and checked his teeth in a small mirror hanging over the samovar. Nga's 50 kilometers away. Good day's walk. We had a big dinner last night. We can make it. Slowly I awakened to the insanity of this proposition. That's behind German lines. Why do we have to go to Nga? It's Monday, Lev. We need the eggs by Thursday, and we're not going to find any in Peter. Sonya's uncle runs that poultry collective out there, right? I'm betting the Germans kept it going. They like their eggs, too. That's our plan? We're going to walk 50 kilometers right past the Germans to a poultry collective that maybe didn't get burned down, grab a dozen eggs and come home? Well, anything would sound ridiculous if you said it with that tone of voice. Tone of... I'm asking you a question. That's our plan? Sonya's never even been there. How are we supposed to find it? It's in Mga. How hard can it be finding anything in Mga? I don't even know how to find fucking Mga. Ah, said Kolya, grinning now as he put on his Astrakhan fur hat. That one's easy. It's on the Moscow line. We just follow the tracks. Timofey grunted in his dreams and rolled onto his side. I'd learned that doctors and soldiers could sleep through any non-life-threatening ruckus. My argument with Kolya might have been a soft-sung lullaby, judging from the look of peaceful contentment on Timofey's face. I looked at him and I hated him. Hated him for getting to sleep on his bed of wool blankets, warm and comfortable and well-fed, with no grandson of Cossacks to harass him, no NKVD colonel sending him out to the wilderness to find ingredients for a wedding cake. I turned back to Kolya, who was adjusting his hat to a properly heroic angle with the help of the mirror. I hated him even more, the cheerful, swaggering brute, happy and fresh at 6 in the morning, as if he'd just returned from a 2-week holiday at the Black Sea. I imagined that he still stank of sex, though the truth was, I couldn't smell anything at all so early in the day, with the apartment so cold. My mighty nose was all show, a good target for bullies' taunts, but strangely bad at picking up scents. You think it's so crazy, he said, but every one of those peasant swindlers selling potatoes for 200 rubles in the Haymarket brought them in from outside the city. People make it past the lines every day. Why can't we? Are you drunk? Off a quarter bottle of vodka? I don't think so. There has to be somewhere closer than Mga. So tell me. He was swaddled now for the weather, his jaw bristling with 4 days' worth of blonde beard, He waited for me to propose my alternative to his stupid plan, but as the seconds ticked past, I realized I didn't have one. He smiled at me, a smile fine enough for a Red Fleet recruitment poster. The whole thing's a fucking joke, I agree, but it's a pretty good joke. Yes, it's a wonderful joke, and the funniest part is that we're going to die out there and the Colonel's daughter won't get her cake, and nobody will ever know what we are doing in Mga. Calm yourself, my morbid little Israelite. I won't let the bad men get you. You can eat shit. But we have to move now, if we want to make it there with any daylight left. I could have ignored him and gone back to sleep. The stove had gone cold in the night. The last of the wood chips burned through, but it was still warm enough under all the piled blankets. Sleeping made more sense than marching out to Mga, where the Germans waited in their thousands, in search of chickens. Anything made more sense than that. Still, no matter how much I protested the idea, I knew from the first that I would follow. He was right. There were no eggs in Leningrad. But that wasn't the only reason for following. Kolya was a braggart, a know-it-all, a Jew-baiting Cossack, but his confidence was so pure and complete it no longer seemed like arrogance, just the mark of a man who had accepted his own heroic destiny. This wasn't the way I had imagined my adventures, but reality ignored my wishes from the get-go, giving me a body best suited for stacking books in the library, injecting so much fear into my veins that I could only cower in the stairwell when the violence came. Maybe someday my arms and legs would thicken with muscle, and the fear would drain away like dirty bathwater. I wish I believed these things would happen, but I didn't. I was cursed with the pessimism of both the Russians and the Jews, two of the gloomiest tribes in the world. Still, if there wasn't greatness in me, maybe I had the talent to recognize it in others, even in the most irritating others. I stood, grabbed my coat off the floor, slipped it on, and followed Kolya to the front door, which he held open for me with grave courtesy. "Wait," he said, before I could cross the threshold. "We're going on a journey. We should sit." "I didn't know you were superstitious." "I like the traditions." There were no chairs, so we sat on the floor beside the open door. The apartment was quiet. Timofey snored from his spot near the stove. The windows shuttered in their frames. The radio broadcast its endless metronome, signaling that Leningrad remained unconquered. Outside, someone nailed posters to boarded windows with quick, efficient hammer strikes. Instead of picturing a man hanging posters, though, I imagined a coffin maker at work, fashioning a casket from planks of pine wood. The vision was intense and detailed. I could see the calluses on the coffin maker's palms, the black hair sprouting between his thick eyebrows, the sawdust on his sweaty forearms. I took a deep breath and looked at Kolya. He was looking right back at me. "Don't worry, my friend. I won't let you die." I was 17 and stupid, and I believed him. Chapter 11. The Moscow line had been cut only 4 months before, but the rails were already beginning to rust. Most of the ties had been pried from the ground and split for firewood, though they were impregnated with creosote and dangerous to burn. Kolya walked atop of one rail, a gymnast on the balance beam, hands held out to the side. I trudged along behind him, in the center of the tracks, unwilling to play his game, partly because I was angry with him, partly because I knew I'd lose. The rails ran east, past red brick apartment blocks and three-story department stores, past the Kotliaro streetcar barns, past abandoned factories that had built things nobody could use or afford during wartime. A crew of young women wearing overalls below their winter coats under the supervision of an army engineer labored to convert a post office into a defensive position. The corner of a sturdy old building had been demolished to make way for a machine gun nest. "Great body on that one," said Kolya, indicating a woman wearing a blue headscarf, lugging sandbags from an idling truck. "How can you tell?" It was a ludicrous claim. The woman was at least 50 meters away. Her jacket was heavily padded, and she wore several layers beneath it. "I can tell. She has a dancer's posture." "Ah! Don't give me your ah! I know ballerinas.
Believe me, I'll bring you to the Marinsky Theater some night, take you backstage. Let's just say I have a reputation. You never shut up about your reputation. There is very little in this world that makes me happier than a ballerina's thighs. Galina Ulanova.
Oh, stop.
What? She's a national treasure. Her legs should be bronzed.
You never slept with Galina Ulanova.
He gave me a small, secretive smile. A smile that said he knew many things, but couldn't share them all at once. I'm being cruel, he admitted. Talking to you about things of this nature, it's sadistic. Like talking about Velázquez with a blind man. Let's change the subject. You don't want to talk about ballerinas you didn't sleep with for the next 39 kilometers?
Three boys go to a farm to steal chickens,
he began in his joke-telling voice. He used a different accent for jokes, though I couldn't tell what kind of accent it was supposed to be or why he thought it made things funnier.
The farmer hears them and rushes over to the farmhouse. So, the boys jump into three potato sacks and hide.
Is this going to be a long joke?
The farmer kicks the first sack, and the boy inside says, Meow, pretending to be a cat.
Oh, he was pretending to be a cat.
I just said that,
said Kolya, looking back at me to see if I was starting trouble. I know he's pretending to be a cat. Once he says, Meow, it's obvious he's pretending to be a cat. You're surly again because I slept with Sonya.
Are you in love with her?
Didn't you have a nice time with, what's his name, the surgeon? You look so cute, curled up together by the stove.
And what's that accent you're doing? Is it supposed to be Ukrainian?
What accent?
Every time you tell a joke, you use some stupid accent.
Listen, Lev, my little lion, I'm sorry. I know it's not easy for you, lying there all night, your meat in your hand, listening to her happiness.
Just tell your dumb joke.
But I promise you, before you hit 18, when's your birthday?
Oh, shut up.
I'm going to find you a girl. Calculated neglect, don't forget.
All this time he continued to walk atop the steel rail, one foot in front of the other, never losing his balance, never looking down, going faster than I could walk in the usual way.
Where was I? The farmer, he kicks the first sack, meow, and so on. He kicks the second sack, and the boy inside says, woof,
pretending to be, Kolya pointed at me to finish the sentence. A cow.
A dog.
When he kicks the third sack, the boy inside says, potatoes.
We walked in silence.
Well,
said Kolya at last.
Other people think it's funny.
On the outskirts of the city, the apartment blocks were no longer stacked one on top of the other. The concrete and brick was now broken by stretches of frozen marsh and snow-covered lots, where future buildings were meant to rise before the war ended all construction. The farther we walked from the city center, the fewer civilians we saw. Army trucks with chains on their tires rattled past, the weary soldiers in the flatbeds staring at us, with no interest, as they motored toward the front.
Do you know why it's called Nga?
Kolya asked. Somebody's initials?
Maria Gregorevna Apraksin.
One of the characters in the Courtyard Hound is based on her.
Heiress to a long line of field marshals, peculators, and royal toilet lickers. She's convinced her husband is trying to murder her so he can marry her sister.
Is he?
Not at first, no. She's completely paranoid. But she never shuts up about it. And then he does start to fall in love with his sister. And he realizes life would be better without his wife around. So he goes to Rachenka for advice. But he doesn't know that Rachenka has been fucking the little sister for years.
What else did he write? Ushakovo, I said. What other books did he write?
The Courtyard Hound, that's it. It's a famous story. The book came out, it was a failure. There was only one review, and the critic absolutely blasted it, called it vulgar, despicable. Nobody read it. Ushakova worked on that book for 11 years. 11 years, can you imagine that? And it disappears, like it was dropped into the ocean. But he starts all over again, a new novel. His friends who see pieces of it say it's his masterpiece. Except Ushakovo's getting more and more religious, spending time with a church elder who convinces him that fiction is Satan's work. And one night, Ushakovo becomes convinced that he is going to hell. He is in a complete panic. He tosses the manuscript into the fire. Poof, gone.
This sounded strangely familiar. But that's exactly what happened to Gogol.
Well, no, not exactly. Very different in the particulars, but an interesting parallel, I agree.
The rails veered away from the road, past stands of birch sapling, too tender for firewood. 5 white bodies lay face down in the white snow. A family of winter dead. The dead father still clutching his dead wife's hand. Their dead children sprawled a short distance away. 2 battered leather suitcases lay open beside the corpses, emptied of everything but a few cracked picture frames. The family's clothes and boots had been stripped away. Their buttocks had been hacked off. The softest meat, easiest for making patties and sausages. I couldn't tell if the family had been murdered by gunfire or knives or an exploding shell, by German artillerymen or Russian cannibals. I didn't want to know. They had been dead a long time, at least a week, and their bodies had started to become part of the landscape. Kolya and I continued east along the Volodya line. He didn't tell any more jokes that morning. A little before noon, we reached the edge of the Leningrad defenses. Thickets of barbed wire, trenches 3 meters deep, dragon's teeth, machine gun nests, anti-aircraft batteries, and KV-1 tanks covered with white camouflage netting. The soldiers we had seen earlier had ignored us, but now we were too far east to be civilians, and too strange of a pair to be army. As we walked along the tracks, a band of young privates, hauling the tarpaulin off a 6x6 truck, turned to stare at us. Their sergeant walked toward us, not pointing his carbine at us precisely, but not pointing it away either. He had the posture of a lifelong army man, and the high cheekbones and narrow eyes of a Tartar. "You 2 have papers?"
"We do," said Kolya, reaching inside his pocket. "We have excellent papers."
He handed over the colonel's letter and nodded toward the truck.
"That the new model Katyusha?"
The tarpaulin had been flung to the ground, revealing racks of parallel rails jutting skyward, waiting to be loaded with rockets. According to what we heard on the radio, the Germans feared the Katyusha more than any other Soviet weapon. They called it Stalin's organ, after the rocket's low and mournful howls. The sergeant glanced at the rocket launcher and back to Kolya. "Never mind about that. Which army are you with?"
"The 54th.
"The 54th? You're supposed to be in Krishi.
Yes,
said Kolya, giving the sergeant an enigmatic smile and nodding at the letter in the man's hand.
"But orders are orders."
The sergeant unfolded the letter and read. Kolya and I watched the privates position the fin-tailed rockets on the Katyusha's rails. "Give them hell tonight," shouted Kolya. The soldiers on the truck glanced at us and said nothing. They looked like they hadn't slept in days. It took all their concentration to load the rockets without dropping them. There was no energy to waste on madmen. Unwilling to be ignored, Kolya began to sing. He was a baritone with a strong, confident voice.
"On the bank, Katyusha starts singing of a proud gray eagle of the steppe, of the one Katyusha loves so deeply, of the one whose letter she's kept."
The sergeant finished the letter and refolded it. The colonel's message had clearly impressed him. He looked at Kolya now with a genuine respect, nodding his head in time with the old song.
"That's the stuff.
I heard Ruslanova herself sing it during the Winter War. Gave her a hand when she was coming off stage. Think she had one glass too many. You know what she said to me?"
"Thank you, Sergeant," she said. "You look like a man who knows how to use his hands. What do you think of that? Always the hellraiser, Ruslanova. But it's a beautiful song."
He slapped Kolya on the chest with the letter, giving it back, smiling at both of us. "Sorry I had to stop you, boys. You know how it is. They say there's 300 saboteurs inside Leningrad and more coming every day. But now I know what you're up to, working for the colonel." He gave Kolya a wink. "I know all about it, organizing the partisans. That's the stuff.
You let us regulars take him from the front. You boys plug him from the back. We'll be leaving hot turds in the Reichstag come summer. Kolya had read the colonel's letter aloud the day we got it, and it didn't mention partisans. It said only that we should not be detained or harassed, as we were operating under the discretion of the colonel himself. But the newspapers were full of stories about simple country folk who had been trained to fight as deadly guerrillas by NKVD specialists. "You keep 'em dancing with the organ here," said Kolya. I didn't know if he was mimicking the sergeant's speech intentionally or not. "And we'll make sure they can't get any more strudel from the Vaterland."
"There you go. There you go. Cut off the supply lines. Let 'em starve in the woods. It'll be 1812 all over again."
"But no Elba for Hitler."
"No, no, not for him. No Elba for Hitler."
I wasn't entirely sure the sergeant knew what Elba was, but he was adamant that Hitler wouldn't get it. "We'll give him a bayonet in the balls, but no Elba."
"We should keep moving," said Kolya. "We have to make him gob by nightfall."
The sergeant whistled. "That's a long way. Stay to the woods, you hear? Fritz owns the roads. But a Russian doesn't need a road to walk on, does he?
Ha! You have enough bread? No? We can spare some. Ivan!"
the sergeant shouted at a scruffy young private standing beside the truck.
"Find some bread for these boys. They're going behind lines."
Chapter 12. Outside of Leningrad, the trees still grew, cows muttered on birch branches, squirrels raced between the firs. The squirrels looked fat and innocent, easy targets for a man with a pistol. They were lucky to live in occupied Russia. We marched through the woods, through open fields of cold sunshine, keeping the train tracks visible to our left. The snow was hard-packed, scattered with pine needles, decent for walking. We were in German-controlled territory, but there was no indication of a German presence, no sign at all of war. I was strangely happy. Peter was my home, but Peter was a graveyard now, a city of ghosts and cannibals. Walking in the countryside, I felt a physical change, as if I were breathing pure oxygen after months at the bottom of a coal mine. The tangles in my gut uncoiled, my ears unclogged. I had strengthened my legs I hadn't felt for months. Kolya seemed affected in the same way. He squinted in the glare of the snow, pursing his lips to blow great gusts of vapor, as delighted by this trick as a 5-year-old. Spotting a green scrap of paper near the trunk of a grand old birch, he bent down to pick it up. It looked normal enough. A 10-ruble banknote, Lenin's eyes glaring at us from beneath his broad, bald head, except the 10-ruble notes were gray, not green. "Counterfeit?" I asked. Kolya nodded, pointing to the sky with one finger as he scrutinized the bill. "Fritz drops them by the bushel. The more counterfeit notes floating around, the less real ones are worth. But it's not even the right color." Kolya flipped the note around and read aloud the printed text on the other side. "The prices for food items and the necessities of daily life have increased enormously, and the black market in the Soviet Union is flourishing." Flourishing is spelled wrong, by the way. "Party functionaries and Jews are working dark deals at home, while you at the front have to sacrifice your life for these criminal." "These criminal. That's nice. They occupy half the country and they can't even find someone who speaks the language." "Soon you will see the reason. So keep this 10-ruble note. It will guarantee your safe return to a free Russian after the war." Kolya grinned and glanced up at me. "You working some dark deals, Leb Abramovich?"
"I wish."
"They think these things will turn us, don't they understand? We invented propaganda. All this is bad tactics. They're irritating the people they're trying to convert. Young man thinks he's found a 10-ruble note. He's happy. Maybe he can buy an extra slice of sausage. But no, it's not money. It's a poorly spelled surrender coupon." He speared the note to a tree branch and set it on fire with his lighter. "You're burning your chance to come back to a free Russian after the war," I told him. Kolya smiled as he watched the note blacken and curl. "Come on. We have a long way to go." After another hour slogging through the snow, Kolya prodded me in the shoulder with his gloved fingers. Do Jews believe in the afterlife? The day before, the question would have annoyed me, but right then it seemed funny. So perfectly Kolya, asked with genuine curiosity and apropos of nothing. It depends on the Jew. My father was an atheist. And your mother? My mother's not Jewish.
Ah, you're a half-breed.
No shame in that. I've always thought I had gypsy blood in me from somewhere up the stream. I looked at him, his eyes as blue as a husky's, a smattering of blonde hair showing from beneath the black fur cap. You don't have gypsy blood.
What, the eyes?
Plenty of blue-eyed gypsies in the world, my friend. Anyway, the New Testament's very clear about the whole thing. You follow Jesus, you go to heaven. You don't, you're off to hell.
But the Old Testament? I don't even remember if there is a hell in the Old Testament.
Sheol.
What?
The underworld is called Sheol. One of my father's poems is called The Bars of Sheol. It was very odd to speak openly about my father and his work. The words themselves seemed unsafe, as if I were confessing a crime, and the authorities might hear. Even here, where the Lit Bureau had no sway, I worried about getting caught, worried about spies lurking in the larches. If my mother were around, she would have silenced me with a look. Still, it was good to talk about him. It made me happy that poems are referred to in the present tense, even when the poet is in the past tense.
What happens in Sheol? They punish you for your sins?
I don't think so. Everybody goes there. It doesn't matter if you were good or bad. It's just dark and cold, and nothing's left of us but our shadows.
Sounds about right.
He scooped up a handful of clean snow and took a bite, let it melt in his mouth.
A few weeks ago, I saw a soldier with no eyelids. He was a tank commander. His tank broke down somewhere in the worst of it, and by the time they found him, the other boys in the tank were dead from the cold, and he had frostbite all over his body. Lost some toes and fingers, a bit of his nose, his eyelids. I saw him sleeping in the infirmary, thought he was dead, his eyes wide open. I don't know if you call them open, if there's no way to shut them.
How do you stay sane with no eyelids? You have to go the rest of your life without ever once closing your eyes.
I'd rather be blind.
I had not seen Kolya morose before. The sudden shift of mood made me anxious. Both of us heard the howling at the same time and turned and looked through the crooked avenues of birch trees.
Is that a dog?
He nodded.
Sounds like it.
A few seconds later we heard the howl again. There was something terribly human in its loneliness. We needed to keep walking east. We needed to reach Mga by nightfall, but Kolya headed off toward the crying dog, and I followed without arguing. The snow was deeper here, and soon we were wading through thigh-high drifts. The energy I had felt 10 minutes before began to seep away. I was tired again, battling for each step forward. Kolya slowed his pace so that I could keep up. If he was impatient with me, he didn't show it. I had my head down so I could choose each footfall. A twisted ankle was certain death now, and I saw the tread marks before Kolya. I grabbed his sleeve to stop him. We were at the edge of a vast clearing in the woods. The glare of sunlight off the hectares of snow was bright enough that I had to shield my eyes with my hand. The snow had been corrugated by dozens of tank treads, as if an entire Panzer brigade had passed through. I didn't know the treads the way I knew airplane engines. Couldn't tell a German Sturmtigers from a Russian T-34s. But I knew these weren't our tanks. We would have already broken the blockade if we had this much armor in the woods. Gray and brown heaps lay scattered across the snow. At first, I thought they were discarded coats, but I saw a tail on one, an outstretched paw on another, and I realized they were dead dogs, at least a dozen of them. We heard another howl, and finally we saw the howler, a black and white sheepdog, dragging itself off the field, its front legs doing the work its hind legs could not. Behind the wounded animal was a blood-smeared trail more than 100 meters long, a red brushstroke slapped across a white canvas.
Come on, said Kolya, stepping into the field before I could stop him.
The tanks were gone, but they had been here recently. The tracks were still cleanly defined in the snow, unblurred by wind. The Germans were near, in force, but Kolya didn't care. He was already in the middle of the clearing, marching toward the sheepdog, and as usual, I hurried to catch up. "Don't get too close to any of them," he told me. I didn't know why he told me that. Was he worried about disease? Did he think a dying dog might bite me? When we got closer to the sheepdog, I could see that a wood box was strapped to its back, held in place with a leather harness. A wood post extended straight up from the box. I glanced around the field and saw that all the other dogs wore the same contraptions. The sheepdog did not look at us. He was intent on reaching the fringe of trees on the far side of the field, where he thought he could find safety, or comfort, or a quiet place to die. Blood dribbled from two bullet holes near his hip, and another must have pierced his belly, for something wet and coiled was dragging along beneath him, innards never meant to see daylight. He panted, his long pink tongue dangling from the side of his mouth, his black lips curling back from his yellowing teeth. "They're mines," said Kolya. "They teach them to find food underneath a tank's armor, and then they starve them, and when the panzers come, they let them loose. Boom." Except none of the dogs had gone boom. The Germans clearly knew all about it. They warned their gunners, and their gunners were good shots. Dead dogs littered the field, but there were no tank carcasses, no upended armored cars, no explosions at all. It was another ingenious Russian ploy that had failed completely, as all of the Russian ploys had failed, and I pictured the hungry dogs sprinting toward the panzers, their paws kicking up fantails of snow, their eyes bright and happy, as they raced for their first meal in weeks. "Give me your knife," said Kolya. "Be careful."
"Give it to me."
I pulled the German dagger from its sheath and handed it to him. The sheepdog kept trying to drag his gutted self toward the woods, but he was losing strength in his front legs. He finally quit when he saw Kolya approaching, as if he had decided that this was far enough. He lay in the blood-wet snow, staring up at Kolya with weary brown eyes. The wood post stuck straight up from the box on his back, like the mast of a sailboat. It seemed a flimsy thing, no thicker than a drumstick.
"You're my good boy,"
said Kolya, kneeling beside the sheepdog, holding the back of the dog's head steady with his left hand.
"You're my good boy."
Kolya cut the dog's throat with one quick motion. The dog shuddered, the blood pouring from him, steaming in the cold air. Kolya lowered the dog's head gently to the ground, where he continued to twitch for a few seconds, pawing at nothing, like a dreaming puppy, and then he was dead. We were silent for a moment, giving our respect to the fallen dog. Kolya wiped both sides of the bloody blade on the snow, dried it on the sleeve of his overcoat, and handed it back to me. "We just lost 40 minutes. Walk fast." Chapter 13. We marched at double time through the birch forest, the railroad tracks to our left, the sun tumbling fast from the sky. Kolya hadn't spoken since the field of dead dogs. I could tell he was worried about the time. He had miscalculated our speed, how fast we could walk across the snow-covered terrain, and our detour had ruined any chances of making Nga by nightfall. The cold was a greater danger than the Germans now, and the temperature was already dropping fast. Without shelter, we would die. We hadn't seen a human being since saying farewell to the Tartar sergeant, and we kept our distance from the abandoned railway stations at Kolonia Yanya and Dubrovka. Even from 200 meters away, we could see the toppled statue of Lenin outside the Dubrovka station, the black graffiti spray painted on the concrete wall. "Stalin ist tot, Russland ist tot, Sie sind tot." At 3 in the afternoon, the sun dipped below the western hills, and the brooding gray clouds above us flared orange. I heard the whine of airplane engines and looked up to see 4 Messerschmitts racing toward Leningrad, so high above us they seemed harmless as fruit flies. I wondered what buildings they would flatten, or if they would be shot down by our boys on the ground, or our pilots in the air. It seemed wonderfully abstract to me, somebody else's war. Wherever they dropped their bombs, it wouldn't be on me. When I realized that thought was my own, I felt a surge of guilt. What a selfish shit I had become. We were walking past Berezovka, a name I had heard in September when the Red Army and the Wehrmacht clashed outside the village. According to the newspapers, our boys fought with great valor and tactical brilliance, outfoxing the German commanders and frustrating Hitler himself, who followed each development from his war room in Berlin. But everyone in Leningrad knew how to read a newspaper article. The Russian forces were always calm and determined. The Germans were always stunned by the fury of our resistance. These phrases were mandatory. The key information came near the bottom of each article, tucked away inside a closing paragraph. If our men withdrew to reserve our fighting strength, we had lost the battle. If the troops gladly sacrificed themselves to repel the enemy invaders, we had been massacred. Berezovka was a massacre. According to the papers, the village was famous for its church, built on the direct order of Peter himself, and a bridge where Pushkin challenged a rival to a duel. These landmarks were gone. Berezovka was gone. A few fire-blackened walls still stood above the snow. If not for that, there would be no sign that the village had ever existed. "They're fools," said Kolya, as we skirted around the hamlet's torched remnants. I looked up at him, not sure whom he meant.
"The Germans. They think they're so efficient. The greatest war machine ever built. But you look at history, you read the books, and the best conquerors always gave their enemies a way out. You could fight Genghis Khan and get your heads lopped off, or you could submit and pay him taxes. That's an easy choice. With the Germans, you can fight them and get killed, or you can surrender and get killed. They could have turned half this country against the other half. But they don't have subtlety. They don't understand the Russian mind. They just burn everything."
What Kolya said was true enough as far as it went, but it seemed to me that the Nazis had no interest in a subtle invasion. They didn't want to change anyone's mind, at least no one among the inferior races. The Russians were a mongrel people, spawned by hordes of Vikings and Huns, raped by generations of Avars and Khazars, Kipchaks and Pechenyegs, Mongols and Swedes, infested by gypsies and Jews and far-roaming Turks. We were the children of a thousand lost battles, and defeat was heavy in us. We no longer deserved to exist. The Germans believed in the lesson of Darwin's mockingbirds. Life must adapt or die. They had adapted to brute reality. We mixed-race drunks on the Russian steppes had not. We were doomed, and the Germans were only playing their mandated role in human evolution. I didn't say any of that, though. All I said was they gave the French a way out. All the Frenchmen with balls died on the way home from Moscow in 1812. You think I'm joking? Listen, 130 years ago, they had the best army in the world. Now they're the whores of Europe, just waiting to be fucked by whomever comes along with a hard cock. Am I wrong? So what happened to them? Borodino, Leipzig, Waterloo. Think about it. Courage got blasted out of their gene pool. Their little genius Napoleon castrated the whole country. We're losing the light. He glanced up at the sky and nodded. If it comes to it, we can build a dugout and make it through till morning. He walked faster, accelerating our already quick pace, and I knew that I couldn't keep up for much longer. Last night's soup was a delicious memory. The sergeant's gift of ration bread had been devoured before noon. Each footstep was an effort now, as if my boots had been lined with lead. It was already so cold I could feel it in my teeth. The cheap fillings plugging my cavities shrunk when the temperature dipped low. But I couldn't feel my fingertips, even though I wore thick wool mittens, and had shoved my hands into the pockets of my overcoat, nor could I feel the tip of my nose. What a good joke that would be. I spent most of my adolescence wishing for a smaller nose, a few more hours in the woods, and I wouldn't have a nose. "We're going to build a dugout? With what? You brought a shovel? You still have hands, don't you? And the knife? We need to get inside somewhere." Kolya made a great show of looking around the darkening woods, as if a doorway might be hidden in one of the tall pines.
"There is no inside," he said. "You're a soldier now. I've drafted you, and soldiers sleep wherever they close their eyes."
"That's very beautiful, but we need to get inside." He placed his gloved hand on my chest, and for a second, I thought he was angry with me, insulted by my unwillingness to brave the winter night outdoors. But he wasn't admonishing me. He was making me stand still. He gestured with his chin to an access road that ran parallel to the train tracks. It was a few hundred meters away, and the shadows were growing deeper, but there was still enough light to see a Russian soldier standing with his back to us, his rifle slung over his shoulder.
"Partisan?"
I whispered.
"No. He's regular army. Maybe we've taken Berezovka back. A counterattack?"
"Maybe,"
whispered Kolya. We crept closer to the sentry, treading carefully. We didn't know any passwords, and no one with a rifle would wait to see if we were truly Russian.
"Comrade!"
shouted Kolya when we were 50 meters away, his hands raised above his head. I raised mine, too.
"Don't shoot! We're here on special orders!"
The sentry did not turn. Many soldiers had lost their hearing in the last few months. Exploding shells had ruptured thousands of eardrums. Kolya and I exchanged a glance and walked closer. The soldier stood knee-deep in the snow. He was far too still. No living man could pose like a statue in cold this severe. I turned a full circle, scanning the woods, convinced this was a trap. Nothing moved but the birch branches and the wind. We walked up to the soldier. He must have been a brute in his day, with his bulging brow and his wrists thick as axe handles. But he'd been dead for days, his paper-white skin wrapped too tightly around his skull, ready to split. A neat little bullet hole, crusted with frozen blood, punched through his cheek, just below his left eye. A wood sign hung from his neck on a wire loop, the phrase, "Proletaria alle Lande vereinigt euch," spelled out with a black marker. I didn't speak German, but I knew the phrase, as did every boy and girl in Russia who had suffered through endless lectures on dialectic materialism. "Workers of all lands, unite." I pulled the sign off the dead soldier's neck, careful not to let the ice-cold wire brush against his face, and tossed it away. Kolya unfastened the strap of the rifle and inspected the weapon. A Mazen Nagant, with a crooked bolt. He tried it a few times, shook his head, and let it drop to the ground. The soldier wore a hip holster with a Tokarev pistol. A leather lanyard ran through a loophole in the hilt of the gun, securing it to the holster. The dead man was an officer, a pistol waver. The Tokarev wasn't meant for Germans. It was for Russians who refused to advance. Kolya drew the automatic, untied the lanyard, checked the pistol's butt, and saw that the magazine had been taken. The ammo loops in the officer's belt were empty, too. Kolya unbuttoned the man's coat and found what he was looking for, a burlap pouch with a steel-buckled leather strap.
"Sometimes we put them under our coats at night," he said, opening the pouch and grabbing 3 pistol magazines. "The buckle's too shiny. Reflects the moonlight."
He slammed one of the magazines home and tried the action. Satisfied the pistol was sound, he stuffed it and the extra ammunition into his overcoat pocket. We tried to pull the dead man out of the snow, but he was frozen into the ground, as rooted as a tree. Dusk was leaching all the colors from the forest. The night was almost on us. There was no more time to spare for corpses. We hurried east, walking close to the tracks now, hoping that any Germans moving through the frozen woods would be in vehicles and easy to hear from a distance. The crows had quit cawing, and the wind had stopped blowing. The only sounds were our boots sinking through the snow and the distant, arrhythmic drumbeat of mortar shells falling around Peter. I tried to hide my face behind the wool of my scarf and the collar of my overcoat, tried to use the warmth of my breath to heat my cheeks. Kolya stamped his gloved hands together and pulled his black fur cap down so low it almost covered his eyes. A few kilometers east of Berezovka, we walked along the perimeter of a large farm, the undulating fields of snow, demarcated with low stone walls. Hay bales, big as igloos, sat abandoned in the fields. The harvest interrupted. The farmers fled to the east, or dead. An old stone farmhouse stood at the far edge of the farm, protected from the northern wind by a copse of large trees 50 meters high. Firelight shone through the mullioned windows, warm and buttery, spilling onto the snow in front of the house. Black smoke plumed from the chimney, barely visible as a curling smudge against the dark blue sky. It looked like the most inviting house ever built, the country residence of the emperor's favorite general, heated and well-stocked for Christmas, with everyone's favorite smoked meats and pastries. I looked up at Kolya as we trudged through the snow. He shook his head but never took his eyes off the farmhouse, and I could see the longing in his expression.
"It's a bad idea," he said.
"It's a better idea than freezing to death on the way to Mga. Who do you think is in there? A country gentleman, sitting by the fire, petting his dog?
You think we're in a fucking Turgenev story? Every house in town was burned down. This one's still standing. What happened? They got lucky? It's Germans in there. The officers, probably. We're going to storm the house with a pistol and a knife? If we keep walking, we're dead. If we go to the house and the Germans are there, we're dead. But if it's not Germans, so let's say they're Russians," he said. "That means the Germans let them stay there, which means they're working with the Germans, which means they're the enemy. So, we can appropriate food from the enemy, can't we? And a bed?
Listen, Lev, I know you're tired. I know you're cold. But trust me. Trust a soldier. This won't work. I'm not going any farther. I'd rather take a chance on the farmhouse.
There might be a place in the next town.
How do you know there is a next town? The last one is Ashes.
How much further to Mga? Another 15 kilometers? Maybe you can make it. I can't.
Kolya sighed, rubbing his face with the back of his leather glove, trying to get some circulation going.
I can see that we're not going to make it to Mga. That's no longer an issue. I've known for hours. You didn't want to tell me about it? How far away are we?
Far. The bad news is, I don't think we're going the right way.
What do you mean?
Kolya was still looking at the farmhouse, and I had to shove him to get his attention.
What do you mean, we're not going the right way?
We should have crossed the Neva hours ago, and I don't think Berezovka is on Mga line.
You don't think? Why didn't you say something?
I didn't want you to panic. It was too dark to see the expression on his stupid Cossack face.
You told me Mga is on the Moscow line.
It is.
You told me all we have to do is follow the Moscow tracks, and they'll take us to Mga.
Yes, all true.
So where the fuck are we?
Berezovka. I took a deep breath. I longed for powerful fists so I could pulp his skull. What's the good news?
Pardon?
You said the bad news is we're going the wrong way.
There isn't any good news. Just because there's bad news doesn't mean there's good news, too.
There was nothing left to say, so I started walking to the farmhouse. The moon rose above the treetops. The ice-skinned snow snapped beneath my boots. And if a German sniper was targeting my head, I wished him good aim. I was hungry, but I knew how to deal with my hunger. We were all experts now at dealing with hunger. The cold was brutal, but I was used to the cold, too. But my legs were quitting on me. Before the war, they were weak, poorly suited for running and jumping, and whatever else legs are meant for. The siege had whittled them down to broomsticks. Even if we had been on the right path to Mga, I never could have made it. I couldn't have walked another 5 minutes. Halfway to the farmhouse, Kolya caught up with me. He had pulled out the Tokarev pistol and held it in his gloved hand.
"If we're going to do this," he said, "we don't have to be stupid about it."
He led me behind the house and made me wait on the back porch, under the eave, where the firewood was stacked safe and dry. A 3-kilo tin of beluga caviar would not have seemed more luxurious at that moment than the neatly stacked firewood, rising in crisscross formations higher than my head. Kolya crept over to a frosted window and peeked inside, the sleek black fur of his Astrakhan cap shimmering in the firelight. Inside the house, music played on a phonograph. Jazz piano. Something American.
"Who's in there?"
I whispered. He held up his palm to silence me. He seemed transfixed by whatever he saw, and I wondered if we had stumbled across more cannibals out in the snowy depths of the country, or, more likely,
the mutilated remains of the family who once lived here. But Kolya had dealt with cannibals before, and he had seen plenty of corpses. This was something new, something unexpected, and after another 30 seconds I disobeyed his orders and joined him at the window, careful not to brush off any of the icicles hanging from the lintel. I crouched beside him and peered over the bottom edge of the glass. Two girls in nightshirts danced to the jazz recording. They were lovely and young, no older than me, the blonde leading the brunette. She was very pale, her throat and cheeks washed with freckles, her eyebrows and eyelashes so light they disappeared when seen edgewise. The dark-haired girl was smaller, clumsy, unable to find the rhythm in the syncopation. Her teeth were too big for her mouth, and her arms were chubby, creased at the wrists like a baby's. You wouldn't have noticed her in peacetime strolling down the Nevsky, but there was something wildly exotic now about a plump girl. Somebody with power loved her and kept her fed. I was so dazzled by the sight of the dancing girls that I didn't realize for a moment they were not alone. Two more girls lay on their bellies on the black bearskin rug in front of the fireplace. Both had their chins propped on their hands, their elbows on the rug, watching the dance with serious expressions on their faces. One looked Chechen, her black eyebrows nearly meeting above her nose, her lips painted bright red, her hair piled up in a wet towel above her head, as if she had just bathed. The other girl had the long, elegant neck of a ballerina, her nose a perfect right angle in profile, her brown hair tied back in tight pigtails. The interior of the farmhouse looked more like a hunting lodge. The heads of dead animals festooned the walls of the great room. Brown bear, wild boar, an ibex with massive curling horns, and a scruffy chin beard. A stuffed wolf and lynx flanked the fireplace, posed in mid-prowl, their mouths open and fangs glistening white. Candles burned in wall sconces. Kolya and I crouched outside the window and stared at the scene until the song ended and the Chechen-looking girl got up to change the record. "Play that one again," said the blonde. Her voice was muffled by the glass, but it was still easy to hear her. "Not again, please," said her partner. "Something I know. Put on the Eddie Rosner." I turned to look at Kolya. I expected him to be grinning, ecstatic about this surreal vision we'd stumbled across in the middle of the snowy wasteland, but he looked grim, his lips pressed together, something angry in his eyes. "Come on," he said, standing and leading me back around to the front of the house. A new record had started playing, more jazz, a trumpeter leading his band in a merry charge. "We're going in? I think they had food in there. I thought I saw some..." "I'm sure they have plenty of food." He knocked on the front door of the farmhouse. The music stopped playing. A few seconds later, the blonde girl appeared behind the mullioned window next to the doorway. She stared at us for a long time without saying anything or making any move toward the door. "We're Russian," said Kolya. "Open the door." She shook her head. "You shouldn't be here." "I know," he said, holding up the pistol so the girl could see it. "But we are, so open the door, goddamn your mother." The blonde looked back toward the great room. She whispered something to someone standing out of sight and listened to the response. Nodding, she turned to look at us again, took a deep breath, and opened the door. Stepping inside the farmhouse felt like entering the belly of the whale, the warmest place I'd been in months. We followed the blonde into the great room, where her three friends stood in an uneasy line, fingers fidgeting with the hems of their nightshirts. The little brunette with the chubby arms looked ready to cry. Her lower lip quivered as she stared at Kolya's pistol. "Is anyone else here?" he asked. The blonde shook her head. "When are they coming?" he asked. The girls exchanged glances. "Who?" asked the one who looked Chechen. "Don't play with me, ladies. I'm an officer in the Red Army. I'm on special orders." "Is he an officer, too?" asked the blonde, looking at me. She wasn't smiling quite, but I could see the amusement in her eyes. "No, he's not an officer. He's an enlisted man." "An enlisted man? Really? How old are you, sweetness?" All the girls were looking at me now. In the warmth of the room, under the weight of their stares, I could feel the blood rushing to my face. 19, I said, standing very straight. 20 in April. You're little for 19, said the Chechen girl. 15 at best, said the blonde. Kolya wrapped the pistol sly, chambering a bullet, a dramatic sound in the quiet room. The gesture seemed over.